Hi, my name is Londe Yusuf.
And my name is Reggie Williams.
And we're the co-founders of Black Film Space. Black Film Space is a grassroots organization dedicated to enhancing the skill sets of Black filmmakers and building a community of creatives. We host events such as screenwriting workshops, panels, mixers, and other events that are designed to support Black content creators.
In the next episode of the Black Film Space podcast, we interview Langston Kerman. Langston is a stand-up comedian, television writer, and actor. He has appeared on Insecure, written for the Oscars, and performed a 30-minute stand-up comedy special on Comedy Central. We talk with Langston about his joke writing process, auditioning for TV shows, what he's learned from writing in TV rooms, and much more. And now, on to our interview. All right, Langston, thank you so much for joining us on the Black Film Space podcast. How are you doing today?
I'm doing well. How are y'all?
Doing good. Thank you so much for joining us. So I'm really excited about this interview because I've known you since you were doing stand-up comedy back in Boston when I was doing stand-up comedy.
Yeah.
And I've just seen so much growth in your career. So, you know, really excited to dive into this. So can you tell us how you got your start with stand-up comedy?
Like most of us, left college relatively aimless and I guess I had plans, or at least thought I had plans, of like going into like some version of advertising, because, you know, you could kind of write and be funny if you were being, you know, creative advertising. And I immediately found that there were no jobs available for me in 2009. And so I moved back to my mom's house and was living in her basement. And had all the reasons to feel like shit didn't work the way I wanted it to. And so in my mind, I went to school. I did all the things that I was supposed to do. I got good grades. I followed the rules more or less, and it didn't work. So I wanted to try something that felt completely my own and wasn't a part of sort of like the strategy that, you know, everybody had set up for us as like the theoretical path to success. And so stand-up comedy ended up being that thing. And like, I had always wanted to do it. I didn't know how to do it, but I went to an open mic down the street from my house and I kept going, and yeah, just kept going from there. And then I got into school, grad school in Boston, which is how I ended up there and where I met you, Reggie.
So, and you're from where?
I'm from Chicago originally. Born and raised in Oak Park, Illinois, if that means anything to anybody.
I'm sure
it's fake Chicago.
Well, people from Chicago have a lot of pride, so I'm sure
exactly.
somebody listening will love it.
For those prideful people, I understand it is fake Chicago. I am under no illusions, but for the people who don't know Chicago, I say that to ease the situation, but it's Oak Park, Illinois.
So would you recommend that people take up stand-up comedy, or
I don't want anybody to ever come into this ever again. There are too many of us to begin with. I'm hoping this quarantine makes way more people want to quit. I just think it's an overcrowded field with a lot of people who aren't nearly as passionate about it as they often pretend to be. So it's an easy thing to sort of become a part of the community of stand-up comedy, because all you really have to do is keep showing up. There's not a vetting system in our world, right? Part of the vetting is just whether or not you're successful or not successful, but there's plenty of people who sort of linger in like a limbo of like just hanging around comedy and take up space. I say all that to say, like, if people want to do comedy, they absolutely should. I'm not actually saying, like, don't you ever come to this. But I do think that, like, what I would much more encourage is just find a creative path that feels more authentic and true to what you are. Like, I think sometimes people start in stand-up because there are no, because it's such an open space. But that's not actually what you want to do. What you want to do is write, or what you want to do is produce, or what you want to do is act. And you're using this as like a stepping stone towards that. And I think the only people who should be doing this are people who plan to, you know, commit to it fully.
it sounds like this is an issue that a lot of industries have, where, like, you know, things get democratized and everyone has access. So I guess I would ask, do you feel like people should take classes to learn how to do stand-up comedy or do improv? Do you feel like those people are better groomed to do stand-up?
I don't think classes can teach you anything. And Reggie, I'm sure you can weigh on this a shit ton. Like, I actually think that that's one of the biggest scams in the world of stand-up comedy, is like somebody being like, I can teach you how to be funny on stage. Like, the best class you could have is going and bombing in front of strangers, and learning from that and doing it all over again. But, you know, if it's something you're passionate about, if it's something you truly believe you are built to do, then hit some open mics, hit some shows, introduce yourself to people and start there.
So you don't think there's any value in those classes at all?
Personally, I mean, no, but
no? Okay.
Maybe I'm a hater and, you know.
No, keep it real. Tell us.
I don't want to be, you know, shitting on, hey, everybody's got to hustle. I'm not mad at anybody teaching a class or providing a service to be able to, like, make a thing happen. But no, I think it's a complete scam.
Yeah, I actually took, before I did stand-up comedy, I did take a class. In my recollection of it, at the time, it didn't feel like a scam. You know, it felt like I was getting some pointers on how to, like, tell jokes better. And I was in an environment, like a really positive environment. And then there was, like, a end of class, like, show with, like, all of our friends and family. And it was, like, I think it gave me some false hope, because I did so well. And then I bombed for like a year after.
Yeah. And so I, when I say scam, and I think you're speaking to it very well, when I say scam, I don't think it's malicious, right? Like, scam sort of has an implication that, like, somebody is waiting in the shadows and, like, taking your money from you. I don't think it's that. Mm-hmm. I just think it's somebody is suggesting to you that you are doing better at a thing than they can actually quantify. Right. So, like, or qualified, like, it's not it. You have to go and be doing this in front of people who do not like you, who have no sympathy for you, who do not actually want you to win, and then somehow figure out a way to trick them into treating you as a, you know, respectful person. That's the art. And so a class is filled with, like you said, Reggie, it's a bunch of people who like you and who are being supportive. And then you do it in front of your friends and your family who care about you more than anyone else. And they're also being supportive. And then you get out in the world and they're like, nah, whatever you were doing in your little class is trash. And I ain't feeling
it. Yeah. No, it's real when you step out there. Yeah. What about improv classes? What about, like, at the Groundlings or UCB? You ever do any of those?
I never did any of them. It's actually one of my biggest career regrets was not getting into improv and, you know, sketch and stuff like that sooner. I think those are probably pretty essential to the growth of an improv actor or sort of a sketch actor, because I think that is how they build community. That is their sort of, like, space to grow and introduce themselves to each other and, you know, be a part of the theaters that ultimately produce, you know, their most successful people. So it's, those classes are there is no sidestepping to those classes, I guess, is sort of where it all lands, unless you're creating your own stuff, which, you know, obviously has a ton of value, but also comes with a lot of different challenges nowadays.
At what point did you start to see growth, or you felt like you were getting a knack for doing stand-up?
Growth is such a subjective thing, right? Like, I started in Chicago. I did 9 months there before I ultimately moved to Boston. And for those 9 months, I never did anything except open mics. I was bombing the entire time. And then I moved to Boston, seeming at least like I had a little more skill than the average person who had just started. And because I was a new face amongst a sea of new faces, and I was a little bit more seasoned, I benefited from that. Okay. And so I think that like I got into a bunch of clubs a little faster than some of my counterparts, and like it also is a very white city. So I think a lot of the black comics were, for better or worse, were sort of elevated faster. I think it, in certain spaces, not all spaces, because some of them were like, just like, no, we like the white guys. But I do think that like some of the other ones were a little thirsty for some diversity. And so like, if you could do 10 minutes and not bomb, you could get into some of the clubs a little quicker. And so I think, you know, that's where, to answer your question, I think that's where I started to feel like I was excelling a little more. But in terms of like actually getting good at the job, I don't think that that really happened until I made it to New York, and found myself like in a just much heavier, much more challenging competition field.
So how long did you, can you kind of go through your timeline? Like how long were you doing it in Boston? How long in New York, and how long in LA?
Yeah, so I did a 9 months in Chicago, then 3 years in Boston. In the interim, I was in grad school, and then I taught high school in Boston for 2 years. And then I moved to New York in 2013. And I did 4 years in New York, while also like, you know, teaching part-time for a while. And then eventually I was able to fully give up all that stuff and just focus on comedy and acting and writing. And I've been in LA now for 2.5 years. So if you're doing the math, it basically means I've been doing comedy for just over 10 years.
What prompted you to move to New York to do stand-up?
I never loved Boston. I'm not from there. It ain't my speed at all. People, as far as I was concerned,
were, you know Reggie's from Boston, right?
Yeah, I know.
I can't say much. It's his interview.
Hey, feel free to chime in. I it's not personal to the individuals who are
from. I know.
So for me was all, I mean, it's a super homogenous city filled with a lot of very grumpy white people. And that's not what I'm from. It's not what I particularly enjoy. And I didn't find it to be a space that was super, you know, helpful in cultivating creativity, or at least healthy creativity for me. So I think the plan was to always leave. And I just wanted to get good enough at the job that when I left, I wasn't, you know, gonna go take all the L's in New York. And so for me, New York was always like this cool, big, sexy city where you could, you know, go be an artist and do the thing. And, you know, as soon as I found a way to make that happen, I did. And then 4 years later, I was like, I'm over this big, sexy city, and I'm going to go move somewhere that has space and people talk to you like humans.
Yeah. Well, okay. I was going to say, did New York meet your expectations professionally, though?
Professionally, it's, I think, as a stand-up comic, it's the absolute best place you can be doing the job. I don't think that there's a better space you can be in. It's, there's too many shows that you're around. You're rubbing shoulders constantly with the most talented people who do this job, whether you planned it or not. They are constantly around. So, I just don't think that there's anywhere that I've been, at least, and I've now been in 4 different scenes that encouraged my growth quite as much as New York City. On the other hand, I had roaches. So, you know, trade off.
I mean, if you only had roaches, that's not a bad deal. Like, I've had roaches, bed bugs, right. Mice. So
I was very lucky in that way.
That's a win. Yeah. This is an experience I had, and I'm curious to know if you've had this experience. When I did stand-up comedy in Boston, I always didn't feel very secure about performing in front of black people, because I mostly perform in front of white people, and I didn't really have a strong sense of identity like in my early 20s.
Right.
So when I did perform in front of black people, it was always like I had to be kind of like this. I felt like I had to be like this deaf comedy jam type of comedian, and that wasn't me. So I'm just curious to know if you experienced that in Boston, in New York, or.
I think Yes, the short answer to that is yes. I don't know that it ever came off in my mind as like needing to be Def Jam or like something other than myself. I think I would often, and this is to my own fault, would go into Black spaces and immediately presume they're not gonna like me. And so it wasn't me like trying to do something else as much as me being like, well, this is gonna be an L, and just going up there and doing exactly what I did in white spaces. So I wouldn't adjust at all and just be settled into these losses. And it took years to sort of get past my own like, you know, misconceptions. And I think a lot of the bullshit that we as Black people sometimes sell ourselves of like, you got to be this way to be down. And it's like, nah, just be yourself. People, we're not dumb. Black mm-hmm. people get it. They just yeah. don't, if shit ain't funny, they're not going to laugh. And if it is funny, they'll laugh and they'll figure out a way to enjoy you for whatever you are. But you have to be your most authentic self, and you have to be open to the people that you're entertaining as much as they need to be open to you. And so I think, you know, if you ever did like Slades or some shit like that, like it's the blackest room in Boston. It's like the one that they'll boo you off stage if you're not good at it. And so like, I would go and try to do spaces like that, but also go in closed-minded, which is, because I like Black people, I want to be around Black people, but I'm also not truly being open to what it means to be in this space. And so I think that's part of the learning curve, right? Is, you know, trying to get past your own ego, essentially, and stop presuming that, like, you know better than the people that you are attempting to entertain.
Love that answer. That was really, really insightful. And I think that could apply to anyone, not just comedians, you know?
I mean, I think it's an ongoing struggle in a lot of our critique right. of each other, right? Mm-hmm. Like Black people more than any other community are constantly critiquing each other. And so much of it is rooted in expectation versus like an honest warmth to each other. Like, it's right. like, I expect you to be away instead of just being like, all right, this is what you are. Let's figure out how to love each other in that.
Right, right. I totally agree. Okay, so we were talking about, you know, moving around to cities. You finally get to LA.
Yeah.
How was that transition? Because LA is the epicenter of entertainment in this country, but it sounds like New York is the epicenter of stand-up. So how was that adjustment?
To be honest, moving to LA has probably been the easiest transition of all the cities that I had to move to, in part because I think I moved here with resources. Like, I didn't know anybody in New York besides like a couple of homies from college. I was a feature in Boston, which means absolutely nothing. Like being an artist in New York City, like I was moving there with credits from Nick's Comedy Stop, like no one gave a fuck. But you know, I moved.
Can you explain what a feature is to everybody? A
feature is the middle act, which means that you are opening for the headliner. But in Boston, all the headliners are local headliners who have been working in that city for like 40 plus years. So like you are opening for a guy whose biggest TV credit was from like 1983, where he was like a guest on like some, you know, fucking like Sanford and Son or whatever.
Oh, it is. My God. He played
the white mailman for one episode. So it's just like you couldn't be more of like a meaningless position in the grand scheme of what it means to be a successful comedian. But in Boston, it holds value, right? Like when you're going from club to club and you're like, yeah, I featured for this person or I work over here. They're like, oh, okay, cool. We'll let you do the same thing for us. But in New York, people are like, I've never heard of that human being or that space that you in my life. So, you know, you start over. And it's a complete start over, and you go and you cut your teeth and figure out how to get people to pay attention to what you're doing. But when I moved to LA, already had TV credits. I was already sort of like a, you know, I wasn't a famous comedian. I'm not a famous comedian now, but I was a person with a little more weight in the community. And so when I was going into spaces, people were treating me, you know, with a little more respect than I otherwise would have gotten if I just started over in this city. And so the same was, I think, true for acting and writing as well, that, like, you know, Insecure had already happened, other stuff, I assume, I can't think of time at this point, but like enough things had sort of like taken place that like I had some credits and people were down to talk to me and treat me, you know, not like a complete idiot.
How would you describe navigating the scenes in LA though? You know, at the different clubs, like, is it very similar to the other cities on the East Coast?
I don't know if I would say that it's similar. I think that there are a few more, LA is a little more like restrictive, I would say, that like you.
Yeah, I feel that. Mm-hmm.
In New York, comics get in everywhere. You show up, you tell somebody you're a comic, they let you stand in the back. That's sort of part of the deal, right? Is because they're constantly encouraging comics to be in spaces, introduce yourself, be a part of whatever that community is. I think LA has a little less of that. There are clubs out here that don't allow comics to come in for free. And if you do, you have to like be with somebody they already know. It's like a lot more of sort of like a red, you know, velvet rope, so to speak, everywhere you go. But I also think that like at the end of the day, comedy is comedy. So part of the game is introducing yourself. Part of the game is just being present in a community. And ultimately that leads to more success than most things, including sometimes being the funniest person in the room.
How often were you performing pre-TV credits and how often do you perform nowadays?
I used to try to go up every single night. I wasn't always going up every night, but I used to try to be out every single night before any TV credits. Now I think I'm a little closer to probably like trying to be out 4 times a week. I think LA, for part of what the struggle of this city is it's a lot more comfortable. Like your home is nicer and your resources are a little more vast. And so I think that like it encourages you to just chill on the couch and not really be working. At least in a more like hungry, grinding kind of way. But I will say that like part of my goal and part of what I strive to do every single day is just find a way to be funny. And so what I think I've learned is that, you know, being on stage every single night is not always useful. It's just feeding my hunger for attention. It's helping make me feel satisfied for a second, but it's not always helping me grow as an artist. Sometimes I need to be in the house and I need to be working on a script, or I need to be like playing in a space that I haven't otherwise played in and think about how I can make funny out of that instead of just like going up and doing the same, you know, 10 minutes that I'd been doing the past month. Yeah.
Gotcha. That makes a lot of sense. How often were you performing when you were in New York?
I was trying to be up every night. I mean, New York, I'm sure you felt this. New York isn't like, you know, like you said, roaches, bed bugs, rats, all the things. It doesn't encourage you to just chill at the crib. Like none of us, unless you're rich, have a nice enough house to just want to hang out there. So you hit up a friend and you go out and hit shows and you go check out things and just try to spend as much time away from home other than sleeping as possible. I lived in an apartment where like the stairs were literally caving in. Like when me and my girl first started dating, she would like go up the stairs and like we would have to go one at a time because you could tell that like it probably wasn't built to be able to hold the weight of multiple people.
Where was this?
Bed-Stuy. I lived in Bed-Stuy for 4 years. I lived in Crown Heights for a year and then Bed-Stuy for three. But it was a good space in terms of like, I had a room to myself. It was like a railroady apartment, but we had separate entrances. So me and my roommate never saw each other except for like waiting on the bathroom kind of thing. Mm-hmm. So as far as like privacy and like a certain type of comfort, it was dope. But also, you know, I could have died. So is figuring out that kind of balance, I think, is always the game in New York. And that is part of what encourages you to get out and go do something.
The reason why I asked that question is because when I was in Boston, I used to perform every night and I was like crazy hungry at one point. It was like, I wouldn't do anything else. And then I moved to New York and I saw a reputable comedian on Facebook write, if you're not performing like three or four times a night, like you will not break through to television. And I thought to myself, I was already kind of hanging on by a thread. So one of the reasons why I stopped doing comedy, I was like, I don't think I want to do this every like three or four times a night for like decades.
Go ahead. Oh no, that's fascinating. That's such a fascinating insight, I guess, to me, because three or four times a night personally sounds excessive. Like, and it is a very New York thing, right? Like, of you have to be up every night, four times a night. You have to be running those bits and figuring out the tags and whatever it is. And it's like, yeah, maybe, or you could like grow as a human. You could like really work on yourself and have something to articulate the next time you get on stage instead of just like being clever at every turn as like some, you know, sidestepping to human connection. But I do think, you know, there is some validity to needing to go up and constantly be working on your craft. I think for years, comics at various levels have been sold a lot of bullshit about like what the rules are for being a true stand-up comic. And the reality is like, we all got to do this shit differently. And part of that is, you know, managing sanity. And so for you, and correct me if you feel like this is incorrect, but like, it sounds like you found yourself bumping up against something that was going to make you feel insane. That like being up and in these spaces three or four times a night was going to drive you crazy. And maybe it, you know, I'm sure you made the right choice, not because you weren't funny, you were very funny, but like, I'm sure you made the right choice in wanting to get away from it. But at the same time, I don't think that that person's take on it, whether reputable or not, is necessarily like the Bible on this shit.
Yeah, I'm just not realizing that after talking to some comedians in LA, and this comic was like, yeah, I get up like three times a week. I'm like, oh, shit, okay.
Yeah. But I know famous comics who, like, famous comics who aren't up all the time. And they manage their ideas differently. They manage their lives differently. They still have, like, you know, families that they care about and want to see genuinely, instead of like feeding into this weird cell that we all have to just be like deadbeat, you know, distant parents so that we can get the best jokes. It's like, nah, I kind of just want to chill with my wife. And then if I can figure out a way to be funny in other ways, or if that feeds some of that beast that then ends up on stage, then dope, we're creating.
Yeah. Can you talk about some of the rookie mistakes that comedians make that you've been seeing?
I mean, I will say that I'm on the road quite a bit. I probably am out, you know, I'm not like touring all the time, but before quarantine, I was probably out like two or three times a month, like for weekends. Mm-hmm. And I will say that, you know, a lot of times, one of the biggest things that I see is that comics don't often know how to interact with their headliners. like featuring comics, hosting comics don't always, like there's either a energy where you are not kind or like welcoming. And that is something like I, as a headliner, I'm like, yo, like I'm not mean, I'm polite. I genuinely, like, if you talk to me, I'm happy to talk back. Like, it's not a weird thing. And like, sometimes I think it's an ego thing where they're like, this is my space. I'm not going to show kindness in this space. I want them to know that I'm funny and see it through my dominance or whatever it is. And then I think alternatively, there are some people who sort of like spend a lot of the weekend bullshitting or not necessarily like, you can tell working on their craft. They're just sort of like phoning it in. But I think more than anything, like the best thing, the best advice that I could probably give anybody who wants to do stand-up comedy is that stand-up comedy in my mind is built on self-reflection. It's built on the ability to listen to a thing and be honest about what happened in that thing that you're listening to or experiencing. Not just selling a story of what you wanted it to be, not just like sort of representing it in a way that makes you come out as a hero, but having an honest moment where you go like, okay, this is where it's embarrassing, or this is where it didn't go the way that I expected it to, and how can I fix it from there? And if you're able to start to hone in on that, I think you're able to start making jokes better. You're also able to start digging into the self more, which leads to more creative material. Like, I think self-reflection is massive in this shit. And so the more time you can spend doing that, the better you become at what we're doing.
What is what's your joke writing process like?
I am of a school, and I say school as if I did any sort of schooling in this, but I do believe that I like writing all my jokes out, like word for word, transcribing them, which is not a popular choice. Like a lot of comics, I think, rather write on stage or just write, you know, the general like beats of a joke and then just work it out through words. I really like the idea, like if I could show you my joke notebooks, they are literally like paragraphs on paragraphs of all the words written out, sometimes even the uhs and the ums and the sort of like beats for like breaks and you know, where the rhythm would kick in kind of thing. And that for me, just, it just helps to see it transcribed. And I don't know why. And if I were like, you know, a smarter man, I probably would have figured out whatever like is broken in my brain that needs to see it all written out on paper. But that just helps me. And so what I often do is write out the entire joke, go run it in some version of what it was on the page, pick out the things that worked or didn't work, and then rewrite it 20 more times over the course of running it again. So I waste a lot of time transcribing, like a shit ton, just rewriting and rewriting again of the exact same bits.
Well, it seems to be working. So, I mean, you know.
Yeah, we'll see. I mean, it'll break me eventually, but for now, yeah, I feel comfortable in the process that I have. And at some point I've had older comics and sort of like more successful comics critique that decision, but also shut the fuck up. You don't know. You know what I mean? Like, yeah, everybody's different. You won doing a thing that you're doing, but you don't know how I'm gonna get whatever I'm getting. So like, nah, you know what I mean? Like, I think all of us take, I mean, and that's also part of the charm of what we do, right? Is like all of us make humor in a way that is so different from the next person. Even the copycats are still unique to the person that they're mimicking. And so I think like I'm never gonna make people laugh the exact same way that like Patrice O'Neal made people laugh. And part of that is like his looseness on stage and like his ability to like make you forget that there's even a chance he memorized or like wrote anything down. And I want a level of looseness, but I also need you to know, you know, I used to write poetry. That's how I got started in any performance.
Oh, wow. So
an element of like what I do that always is going to have like this poetic, you know, tint to it, I guess. And so I think it's just finding that balance of like, okay, this is what my sound is. This is what my energy is. How do I make that its funniest? And how do I not let somebody else's take on what I'm doing disrupt what I know to be good?
So what happened with poetry?
I think that I still love poetry very much. I think that it was the absolute most effective thing that ever happened to me, was discovering as a high school student a way of communicating emotions and feelings and frustrations and, you know, even dialogues that I wasn't able to have in real life on a page. And I think that as I got further into poetry, in performance poetry specifically, I found myself running into this challenge of when you perform a poem, when you write a poem, you are articulating a singular, oftentimes singular, emotional state, right? When I write a poem about being mad at my dad, I am writing about that feeling and I'm articulating that and I'm bringing it to life. And then when I go and perform that poem, I have to then present that as if I am still mad at my dad. And it leaves me locked into that emotional state. I have to always be angry at my dad as long as that poem is going to be effective. And I think I found myself feeling frustrated with being an ever-changing, growing person who's recognizing like, yo, I'm not even mad at my dad anymore. This shit don't even bug me. Like, I got it out. This was cathartic and I feel better. But in order for this poem to work, I got to go like be angry at him in front of strangers. And that ain't it. You know what I mean? Like, it just felt limiting. And so... Okay. I really love the art, and that's what I went to Boston for. I got a master's in poetry, but I also like, I fell in love with page poetry, and so that was more my focus. And then after a while, it wasn't even about that. It was just more of like, okay, I think where my creativity sort of lives best is in a space that I can be ever changing and wrong on certain ideas or miscommunicate things, and somehow that also is funny or interesting or engaging. And so poetry didn't so much die as it like just, I think comedy evolved from it, if that makes sense. It blossomed.
Yeah. Out.
Was the Oscars, was that your first TV writing gig?
Yeah, it was my first like real gig period, I think. I mean, I think I did Adam Devine's House Party just before that. So that was like me doing stand-up on TV for the first time. But the Oscars was the first time that I ever wrote for anything, certainly anybody. And it, weirdly enough, was the most, you know, important somebody of that time. So, you know, I got very lucky that I was working on this development project with this company that had produced Top Five, which was Chris Rock's movie. And then they liked me. And so they threw my name out as somebody he should check out. And then weirdly enough, he came and saw me at this show in Brooklyn, and he didn't hate it. I don't know that he loved it. I don't know that if he did love it, he has the ability to articulate that he loved it. But he was kind and, you know, very, he did an impossibly generous thing by bringing me onto a team that did not necessarily need me in the grand scheme of things.
What was the process like writing for the Oscars?
Hard. Not necessarily because like writing jokes is hard. It is, but that wasn't the thing. It's a room. It was a room of 15 people. Like 15 other writers, all of whom, except for three of us, had like a a much more intimate, much more familiar, like shorthand with Chris, like knew him well, had written for him for years. And it was, you know, it's not, some writers' rooms are super collaborative and like it's people working together for a greater good. This had a much more competitive sort of vibe to it, where it was like, okay, these are the jokes I wrote. I'm going to try to get these in. I'm hustling constantly to try to get my bits to work or get him to notice me at the end of this giant table. You know what I mean? It just was sort of like a competitive energy at all times. And if you haven't done that before, it feels like you're not doing good. Like you are bombing essentially, because you don't have the ear of the guy. You don't have the ear of the room. You, as far as everyone concerned, are the baby. So it, unless you're like phenomenal, you can't really, really, you know, navigate that space as well as you would like. And so I think in retrospect, I'm very grateful for it. I'm happy that I was a part of it, but I also don't know that I would say that I loved it as an experience, if that makes sense.
Yeah. So you were, how long was the process, and how did it work exactly? Like, did you write jokes on your own and then come together and share them? Like, what was it like exactly?
Yeah. We probably wrote for like 2 months by ourselves. I like spent 2 months just writing jokes on my own, like watching every movie and then trying to come up with like 10, 20, 30 jokes about whatever that movie was. And don't say wow.
No, I mean,
some
that's
of
a
them
lot.
Were real
that's
bad.
A lot. That's really, that's a great exercise.
That's a lot. Yeah.
I mean, I guess it's one of those things where it's like you watch the Danish girl and you go like, Danish, she looked more like a lesbian to me. It's like, okay, I don't know if that's a joke as much as it is just a desperate clinging to like something to have on a piece of paper, if that makes sense. But I do think, like you said, it was a great exercise. And so then you submitted all these jokes to, there were two head writers. You submitted the jokes to them. They would filter through them. They tell you, oh, this is funny, this is funny, this is funny kind of thing. And then you would hope that they showed them to Chris. And what you ended up finding out was like, sometimes they showed them to Chris. I think they often did show them all to Chris. I don't think he read most of them. I think he, you know, to his credit, pretty much wrote, I would say 90% of that show on his own, right? Like as far as the monologue and like all the stuff that he said, obviously like the bits, the sort of like bigger gags, that was more collaborative. But like the monologue, it was mostly him. He just needed writers to be able to punch up and add in, you know, ideas where he may not have made it all the way to the end, if that makes sense. And so part of what you learn is like, when you're Chris Rock, when you're Dave Chappelle, when you're a lot of these guys who sort of can't go and just, and Dave's probably an exception to that, so I shouldn't say him, but I think Chris Rock is a great example of it. He's not a guy that like goes and works out jokes constantly, right? He's not in the clubs constantly the way that like a Dave or a Bill Burr is. So part of the way that he works out bits is he gets a bunch of funny people in a room and he just runs his bits. And he sees what's landing and what it's how he open mics now. It's like, I'll get the most famous people I know, or, you know, a collection of people who are very talented and up and coming, and make them listen to it and then add to it over and over again.
What about your television writing experience? Like on the show, The South Side, what was that like?
We're still writing. Southside, so came out last year, mm-hmm. To as many good reviews as Comedy Central can allow for whoever can see Comedy Central at this point. But it seemed to do really well, and now we're in season two, and we're doing a lot of writing over Zoom because of quarantine and whatnot, but like,
yeah,
it's still very much happening, and I'm really proud of that show. It's an all-Black room, excluding the director, who's white, and it's, you know, all people from Chicago, I being the sort of one exception being from Oak Park, but like everybody else is pretty much a Southsider or like, you know, Southside adjacent kind of thing, and like very much in tune with the culture and language and community of Chicago. So it feels like, you know, we're doing a nice thing, a beautiful thing for the city that we love, as opposed to this weird culture vulture thing where, you know, some shows sort of feel like, ah, this is just generic city that you put Chicago's name on, didn't love dearly kind of thing. But no, it's a great process. I'm really, yeah, I'm super honored to be a part of it. And I'm just a writer, so it isn't like I'm like, I didn't make it. But I, yeah, I'm really happy to be in there.
What's something that you've learned from being in that writer's room?
The showrunner is really, 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 really smart in his ability to hear jokes and then make them work for what we need. And that, I say that to say that, like, I think a lot of times as a stand-up, so much of our work is individual, right? We just do stuff for us. And so we aren't always writing jokes for even the characters that we're pretending to write for, or writing our jokes and then being like, this person could say that. And he has a phenomenal ability to hear something and then be able to re-engage it in the language and energy of a character that doesn't even exist really, but like we, you know, apply it essentially to the characters that we need instead of just forcing it down the throat of somebody. And so that's super helpful when you're trying to create a show, because it makes your characters really feel authentic and not just like a writer's room filled with Hollywood dorks who came up with clever things for, you know, this motherfucker from the South Side to say. Like, if it feels overwritten or if it feels too sharp or precise, it starts to feel like this inauthentic thing. And I think he's really good at figuring out a way to remind us that, like, hey, they work at a Rent-A-Center in Inglewood. This can't sound like a bunch of, you know, fancy degrees came up with a witty sentence. Yeah.
It has to be specific to the environment.
Yeah, exactly. But also, you know, it can't lack clever, right? It can't not be well written. Mm-hmm. And so that is a difficult dance. And I think it's something that a lot of shows can struggle with. And I think he, and I'm not saying his name, Bashir Suhailuddin is really good at figuring out ways to make sure that we are both being our wittiest, cleverest self while simultaneously making sure that the characters feel like honest people.
Can you tell us about maintenance of your skill set? What do you do to like stay sharp? Do you have like acting coach? Do you take classes? Like, what do you do?
I should. I man, I know I should. It's not even like you're telling me something I don't already know. I've always like been like, man, I should call somebody, really like make them work with me. But I mostly, for a long time, one of the things, I never took any acting classes. I'm not classically trained in any way. I think a lot of it is just sort of leading with confidence and then getting roles that kind of match your energy. So I say all that to say that, like, if you could see every audition I take, some of those are real stinkers because Papa doesn't have range. But I think what I have learned over the course of, you know, the time that I've been acting is I like to take as many auditions as possible. Sometimes just because they are part of the learning process. So it isn't that I believe that I'll book this role. In fact, I'm 100% certain I won't, but I can use this, you know, set of sides as a chance to like get a little sharper or more comfortable in front of the camera or practice in a thing that I otherwise would be uncomfortable doing. And that I think has been helpful, at least in building my confidence. I don't know that it's like made me some phenomenal actor, but I do think that it's really like, it's made me feel less like an idiot when, you know, I'm asked to step slightly outside of my range versus, you know, I think previously when, if it wasn't someone identical to myself, I couldn't. Mm-hmm.
Can you tell us more about how you got into TV acting?
Yeah. Do you remember Alingon Mitra?
I don't.
Okay. He was a comic in Boston. He might've been after your time, after mm-hmm. you, cause you left Boston, right? And moved to New York.
Yeah. Like basically 2011 beginning.
Right. So Alingon and I pretty much started in Boston at least around the same time. And he's very funny. He lives in New York now. Super cool, funny dude. He did pretty well 1 year in the Boston Comedy Festival. I think the first year he did it, he got like semifinals, which in the grand scheme of things means absolutely nothing before a bunch of
when you're starting off, that's a feat.
Yeah, for a bunch of people in Boston, and specifically for somebody who, like, he was kind of my partner in crime for a while. We would like go and hang out at clubs together and like try to be figuring out this thing at the exact same time, right? So he got to the semifinals, and so we were like, "Fuck yeah, Lingon's killing it!" And then MTV was at that semifinal. Right. And so they saw him. They were like, "You're so funny. You should come to New York and have a general meeting with us." Again, at the time, I'm like, "General meeting? Alingon, you've made it." So he went to New York and he sat down with them. And they were like, and I remember him telling this story, and I tell it all the time because it really was like a life changing story for me. And it's not even my story necessarily, but he went to New York. He had this general meeting with them. They were like, "Alingon, we think you're phenomenal. You're so funny. What do you do?" And he was like, "Oh, I do stand-up, right? You saw it. You came. You liked me. You remember you said I was funny? I do stand-up." And they were like, "Yeah, no, we get that. You're great at stand-up. What do you do?" And he was like, I don't know. I do stand-up. That's what I have to offer to you today, MTV. And they were like, "Okay. Cool. Thank you for being here. Enjoy the ride back to Boston." And that wow. was the end of that conversation. Now, obviously, it wasn't as short as that and polite as that, but that ultimately was the synopsis of it, right? And so he came back to Boston and he told me that story. And I remembered walking away from that and being like, "Oh, if I don't start to figure out other stuff, I'm not going to make it. Like, I'm not going to really hold value beyond just being a dude who's funny in a room, because there's no money in stand-up. There's no like real value in this for them beyond just like a engaging with a funny person. So I have to learn to write, and I have to learn to act, and I have to learn to produce, and I have to learn to create in a way that steps outside of this world at least a little bit, because otherwise they're going to think I'm an idiot." So that's what I started doing. I was like, "Okay, I'm going to start finding acting auditions. I'm going to start writing my own script." I wrote my own pilot that year because I was like, "Fuck it. I just need to have something." And it's the best thing that I ever learned from anybody's choices, was like, "Oh, this industry does not care that you can be funny for 10 to 60 minutes at a time. What they care about is what that funny then means for everything else that's being created. And if you can't add to that, then you are a burden in their eyes."
Wow.
And obviously, you know, there in history, there are plenty of exceptions to that rule. There are people who never did acting or never really like stepped outside of that. But more and more, I think now, those people don't even really exist. Right. You know what I mean?
Hard like, to do too. It's hard.
Yeah. I mean, even the fucking, you know, Bill Burrs of the world are in The Mandalorian and Breaking Bad. Like, it's not, and he didn't have to do those things. He could have just lived off of touring, whatever, but like most people have to do something.
Right.
And the people that are sort of like in the world where they're just like, nah, I'm just going to do comedy and that'll be all the, you know, the thing I need. I don't know. Maybe I'm wrong. And I'm not here to dismiss anyone's career path in the same way that, like I said, shut the fuck up about mine. But like, I think, yeah, so much of what we do requires adding hyphens to the work. And that day, more than any day, had taught me that like hyphens matter.
Oh, yes. Today, yeah. You got to know how to do a lot. Even us as, you know, content creators, things right. can change, you know? And I mean, things are changing and we have to be able to do, need to be able to write, produce, direct, you know?
But also you have to know social media. You have to exactly. know, it, if nothing else, know how to connect with the people that can teach you
right.
these things effectively. Like, I think it's not so much that like this other stuff has to be your deepest passion. At the end of the day, stand-up is the thing I love the most,
mm-hmm.
but I have to build a skill set in a bunch of other spaces mm-hmm. in order for stand-up to ultimately be what the thing I do the most, right? If I can get good, and that was my mindset, like if I get good enough at acting or at least get successful enough at acting, shit, I could go do stand-up whenever I want.
Right.
But if I just only do stand-up, I'm at the whim of whoever likes me or doesn't like me.
That's true.
And I ain't buddy enough with, you know, the owners and the bookers and the other comics to benefit, you know, totally from just being the funniest person in the room, which sometimes I am, sometimes I'm not. But like one way or the other, that's a tough gamble. But getting good at stuff is never, it never works against your, you know, ultimate goal.
So what was it like? I mean, speaking of, you know, expanding your skill set and talents, what was it like to like audition and acting for acting roles for the first time?
Embarrassing. It sucks. Nothing yeah. about it feels good. I mean, auditions are probably the most raw sort of like shameful things that at least I personally experience. I don't love auditioning, but I also think that, you know, that's the dance, that's the challenge, right? Like I'm not above it. I ain't offer only, so I gotta go out and ask people to like me, and you learn different, you know, tools every time you do it. And so it's, yeah, it sucks. I got very lucky even in Boston. One of the first like acting auditions I ever did, I booked, and it was Clear History, which was that film that Larry David had on HBO. And so like I went in, I auditioned with the casting director and she liked me. And I was just playing a dude in a coffee shop who recognizes him while he's wearing, I think he had like grown a super long beard and long hair as like a disguise. Or like had grown it because that was his look at the time. I can't remember how it goes in the movie, but I was a dude who's like, oh, you're the dude from the thing. And then he gets embarrassed and he's like, no, you're not. No, you're confused. I'm like, no, it's him. It's him. And then the whole coffee shop goes crazy because we recognize him. And so like I went, I auditioned for the casting director. She liked me. The next day they were like, hey, we need you to come do improv with Larry David. And I had to go back in there and do basically like a 2-minute improv scene with Larry David.
Oh my God.
I didn't know shit. I wasn't an improv guy. I didn't know shit about acting.
Right.
But I knew like, okay, the scene means I got to make this dude feel embarrassed. I'm just going to yell stuff. And I did. And he was like, all right, you're fine. And then I got the part.
You're fine. I love it.
Yeah, I mean, he's very much the character that he seemed to be. He's like, all right, very good, thank you, and you know, sent me along my way. But yeah, no, I again, like that could have gone 100 different directions, and I got lucky, right. And right. I'm grateful that like I didn't get too scared to try it, or you know, make some bold choices when I was in the room. But at the end of the day, like, if I didn't get that part, you know, I don't know. It just sort of becomes like these small things that build your confidence, because that part didn't do shit for my career, right? But just builds your confidence and makes you feel like I'm a capable human being in a way that then leads to the next thing.
Yeah. What was your experience like on Insecure and Bless This Mess?
Insecure is really cool. I'm really glad to have been a part of it. Like, you know, Issa is super talented and very much the person she seems to be on camera, both in being endearing and in being uncomfortable. It is, you know, I'm really happy to have been a part of it, and I'm really grateful for them taking a chance on me. And that similarly was like one of those auditions where I had met with Prentice Penny, who is the showrunner there, previous to Insecure coming up. And so when we were just meeting about some script stuff, and when he got Insecure, he thought of me as like a potential for one of the roles. And then I auditioned, and it worked, right? Like it seemed to have sort of landed. And so I'm happy to have been a part of it. I will say that like part of my challenge in Insecure, this isn't a judgment of the show, it's more like just the reality of what I'm discovering as an artist, was like, Insecure isn't necessarily like what I personally as an artist get excited to play necessarily, right? Like as a comic, you want to be funny. My character, mm-hmm. That wasn't my utility in that show. My utility was sort of being this good guy who like is trying his best and like dealing with this girl who can't quite figure out how to, you know, manage her own life and subsequently manage their relationship. And so I'm mostly playing, you know, this guy trying to make it work. And that's not as thrilling as an artist for me to just be like showing up and being kind, as opposed to like when you get to be edgy and or funny or silly or just something a little outside of whatever that sort of role is, gives you a little more stimulant. So I say all that to say I love the show. I'm proud to have been a part of it. I think when you ask, like, what was that experience like? It's like, it was dope. It's not my dream role, but I loved
being
part of it. And if I get the chance to do it again, I'll happily, you know, continue to do so.
You gonna be there for season 4?
I can't say one way or the other.
Oh,
watch.
Oh my gosh.
No, I think you're taking this in a direction you probably shouldn't. I think you should take that as me being respectful of a group of artists making art more than it is me leaving you some sort of things to look out for. I do not want to be held responsible for any disappointment people feel. At
the Understood. No problem.
But nah, like I think, yeah, and that's also something that like I, you know, try to be respectful of, like, you know, they're making something that requires an element of like surprise, right? Like mm-hmm. people mm-hmm. want to be surprised when they see these characters pop up or not, or right. like see what happens with what everybody's doing. And so, the show's dope and I'm excited for them. You know what I mean? And then Bless This Mess, we just wrapped. It's such a sharp, talented group of people, arguably the most talented people that I've ever like played with in terms of acting. And so like pound for pound, everybody is just really good at what they do. And I feel really lucky to be able, you know, Pam Grier's my mom. That's not a thing that most people are going to be able to say that they got to do when they were acting at all. And like Ed Begley Jr. and Lennon Parham and, you know, Dax Shepard, Lake Bell, David Koechner, like everybody is really, really good at what they do. So I'm happy to be there and be the worst at it.
So who are some comedians that you would consider to be masters at their craft?
I think Dave Chappelle is the best that's ever done it. I just think that, like, there aren't, I like to think, I don't like to think, I think that there are a few sort of like specific elements of stand-up comedy that all help to make for a great stand-up comic. Like, part of it is your ability to like set up punchline, right? Do a traditional joke. Some of it is storytelling. Some of it is like sincere engagement, right? Like the emotional, adding emotional truth to whatever you're doing. Dave Chappelle does all of them at the best level. Like there's no element that he's short in. And he has the ability to make things seem like he didn't practice them or rehearse them. Sometimes I'm not even sure if he did. And I do this shit, you know what I mean? Like, and I usually, like most magicians, I assume, can tell where the trick is happening or what happened. I'm not always aware of what his magic is, but I know it's magic happening in front of me. And that's a phenomenal thing to be able to pull off. I just think he's the absolute best. And then there are other people who, like, I think I mentioned him earlier, Patrice was one of my favorites. He does something completely different than what I'm able to do, and certainly had very different opinions on things than I think I have. Like, I don't know that there's an artist that I disagreed with more as a human being. But man, was he good at being funny. And that was part of the skill, right? Was like, at the end of the day, his take on women and sometimes race felt jarring and for some people upsetting, but he figured out a way to make that shit funny. And that's the job. Like, I think we oftentimes get caught up in some weird responsibility, especially now, of being correct while we're being funny. And that's not really the job. The job is to be funny. And so I have no interest in being like a shock comic who like is, you know, putting people off by my edgy take on some shit that I don't even agree with. But at the same time, I don't want to be limited by like this fear of upsetting, you know, some group of people who might take what I said in a mean way at the sacrifice of a good joke. So it's finding that balance, and he had a really amazing way of like not giving a fuck about what that balance was and just finding the funny in, you know, a human way at the same time. And then there's, you know, other people who I think are really fucking amazing, that like Maria Bamford is like so good at like being someone else while also still being herself in a bit. And that's really hard to do. And I'm always amazed at her ability to do that. Mike Birbiglia's ability to like get quiet on stage, which is super undervalued for a lot of comics. Like, we spend so much time trying to get big laughs, make people fill the room with laughter, but Mike can get like quiet for 3 minutes and make us think about some shit and then get a laugh after that. And one of the things that I'm learning is like, and Gary Goldman actually said this to me, who was also one of my favorites, he said it to me years ago when I was still living in Boston, that like quiet is as valuable as laughter is, because it's engagement. If the audience is at a hush, they are as engaged as they would be if they were slapping their knee or the table or whatever the fuck it is. And so it's all a manipulation. We're just trying to manipulate energy. And the better you can do that, the more effective you are at comedy. And Mike Birbiglia is really good at effectively, you know, engaging his audience at all times. John Mulaney is just joke writing pound for pound, I think, is, you know, one of the best. Roy Wood Jr., same. Like, I think he's one of those people that just like every time I see him, and he's prolific, he writes a shit ton. is just always making something funny and interesting and saying something in the process. And then there, you know, there's my peers who I think are really funny. Sam J has an hour coming out on Netflix that I'm really excited about. Jack Knight and I are writing partners, and he's also just pound for pound one of the best stand-ups I know. Chris Red is super funny. He's on SNL. He's great. And then there's, you know, younger comics who are still like in their formative whatever, but like are fucking great. Ryan Donahue is so good. Yeah, I could keep going forever, but like, nah.
Mm-hmm. I actually have one last question I forgot to ask. How often do you write?
Every day.
Nice.
Yeah. It doesn't mean every day is productive. Some days are better than others. Like some days it's just rewriting. Some days it's just staring at a page and feeling ashamed. But every day I try to write something comedic. And I would say at least five days a week, it's stand up. And so also other stuff, right? Because, you know, I'm writing my own shows and working on my own projects and stuff like that. So that writing has to happen. But then I'm also like every day trying to sit down for an hour to 2 hours and just like make some bits. So, you know, I like I said, I used to be a high school teacher. That's the hardest thing I've ever had to do. And so what I learned was like, if that's a job that I can handle, then I can handle this job fine. This isn't going to be that taxing. And so I treat it like a job. I clock in, not always on time. There's no real clock. So like, I don't always do what I'm supposed to do when I'm supposed to do it. But every day I try to sit down and like engage my notebook and see if I can make something better than the day before.
So tell us what we should expect from you in the future and what to look out for.
Oh, well, there are still more episodes of Bless This Mess coming. I think episode 17 of season 2 is this week, every Tuesday at 7:30, I believe, on ABC. So you could watch that. And I'm in the new season of The Boys on Amazon, which is coming sometime. I don't know. They don't tell me shit. But yeah, if you watch The Boys, which is a super dope show about like fucked up superheroes, then you can see me in that. And watch Southside on Comedy Central. We're in the middle of writing season 2, but I hope that once pandemic has at least sort of like come to a calm, we'll be able to shoot this summer, and the new season will come after that. And yeah, and then in the interim, I'm just sort of working on a bunch of stuff for myself and trying to make it all happen. So it would feel weird to promote it because I don't know that it may ever exist, but I'm trying to make it happen. And you can follow me on Twitter and Instagram at Langston Kerman.
Word, word.
Thank you, Langston, for
thank you.
Chatting with us today. This is a lot of fun. We wish you the best.
Thanks for listening to the Black Film Space podcast. If you're interested in being part of our community and attending events, please visit us at blackfilmspace.com and follow us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at Black Film Space. Subscribe to our email list and podcast. All right, see you soon. We'll be right back.